So I did it. I used a sermon title that's off of a movie title. I make fun of things like that, but I could not resist. I just felt like it really fit what was going on in this passage, so you can throw all the comments at me afterwards, I know, but you're going to see that this kind of makes sense. So our title for today is The Lord of the Kings, The Lord of the Kings. And it's kind of interesting because in The Lord of the Rings, there's battles and fights, and so it kind of, you know, it just all really kind of flows together. But today we're going to be continuing. We're almost done with the battle aspect of Joshua. So we've been through a lot of battles, haven't we? There's been a lot of faith. There's been a lot of courage, a lot of boldness on the part of Joshua and Israel, and that continues in our sermon that we have today. We're going to be looking at Joshua 11, verses 1 through 15. In Cuba, there is nothing bigger than baseball, not even cigars, nothing that is, or what used to be, Castro. Recently, or a few years back, I guess, when this was written, the 74-year-old dictator grabbed an aluminum bat and walked up to the plate in an exhibition game against Venezuela. When Castro approached the batter's box, the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, left his first base position to take the mound and pitch to the dictator. His first pitch didn't even reach the plate, and Castro kept his bat on his shoulder. The next pitch went by, strike. Castro swung and he missed. A couple more balls and an attempted bunt, and later on the two heads of state were locked in a full count, so 3-2. So they could either be, he can either be out or he can walk and take his base. Castro watched as the 3-2 pitch sailed past him and then heard the umpire call, "Strike, you're out." Castro turned around to the umpire and said, "No." Dropped his bat and walked and took first base. Nobody said anything. The opposing team said nothing. The Chavez said nothing. Even the umpire said nothing. The life of a dictator. Nobody can call you out. You have the power to overrule everybody. Walk and take your base. We're going to meet a similar king today. King Jabin. Whether that's his name or not, we're not sure. It could have been what they call a dynastical name. But this king was the king of Hazor. God is calling him out. God has said, "Your time is done. You need to head to the dugout, King Jabin." Jabin looks at God, stands up, and says, "No." He's going to walk and take his base. And what we are going to see today is really the tale of two kings, the tale of an earthly king and the tale of the king of heaven and earth. And the tale of the earthly king, we are going to see what happens when these people in power and those that follow these people in power, what happens when they stand up and rebel against God. We're going to look at three stages in this passage that I see here today. So the first stage for these kings and these people in power is they do just that. They stand up. They rise up. Jabin has been called out. He is being challenged. He rises from his throne and he says, "No." Verses 1 through 5. "Then it came about, when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, he sent to Jobab, a king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and the king of Ashvah, and the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and the king in Arabah, south of Chinnereth, and in the lowland in the heights of Dor, and on the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite in the foot of the Hermon in the land of Mizpah. They came out, they and all of their armies with them, as many as the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Similar, it's like deja vu, isn't it? Didn't we see this story before? Isn't this the same thing? But there's a little twist to this story today. And its focus is really on this king and those who follow him. But so this king of Hazor, as we can see, he gathers together all of these armies. He does the same thing as the king of Jerusalem did. The first thing that he does is he turns to those that he trusts in. He gathers all of these armies together and he says, hey, look, they're coming after us. We're not going to stand for this. We need to fight against them. And this force is much, much larger and more is better equipped than that in our previous chapter. In a simple way to pray, Martin Luther says this as he advises his friend Peter to repeat and elaborate on each petition of the Lord's Prayer. For example, regarding the second petition, Thy Kingdom Come, it might be developed something like this. Say, O dear Lord God and Father, Thou seest how worldly wisdom and reason not only profane thy name and ascribe the honor due to thee to lies and to the devil, but how they also take power, they take might, they take wealth and glory, which you have given to them on earth for ruling the world and for serving thee, and they use it to their own ambition to oppose thy kingdom. They are many. They are mighty. They plague and hinder the tiny flock of thy kingdom who are weak, despised, and few. Defend us against those who will not turn away from their might and their power from the destruction of thy kingdom, so that when they are cast down from their thrones and are humbled, they will have to cease from their efforts. Martin Luther understood what man does when he has power. This is the pattern of man. This is the pattern of kings. This is the pattern of those who possess power. They take. King Hazor, the king of Hazor, took everything that God has given him. This was given to him by God. He takes it and he uses it to oppose the king of the kingdom who gave him all of this. He stands. This is idolatry. What we have seen here throughout this text and what we've seen throughout the Joshua narrative is the results of idolatry. God gave these individuals all a chance a long time ago. And what has happened is that they did not turn and worship the one who gave them these things. They turned and worshiped their own creation. And now when that creation, when that power, when their might, when their wealth, when all that they have is being challenged, they are going to fight for it because they believe that they are fighting for their gods. And that God is man. King Hazor, the king of Hazor, King Jabin, sees no other king except himself. And he's not going to stand for it. Man is given power. God sets kings and takes them down, but these kings and kingdoms become an end to themselves. serving their own pride and self-interest. And when the Lord of these kings comes to judge them, they fight, they rebel, and once again they form alliances with each other, not trusting in God, but turning to man, the very person they worship to begin with. It's interesting. We have seen this word heard. It said the king of Hazor, King Jabin, heard. We've seen that word numerous times throughout our text. The kings hear and they fear. The kings hear and they fight. Rahab heard. What did she do? She bowed the knee. Two choices. Rahab always stands out. What she heard, she took to her heart and she listened and she understood who the true king was. This guy heard and he stopped up his ears. He hardened his heart. And what did he do? He turned to fight against the only true king. In his book, We Become What We Worship, I don't know if you've ever heard that book, G.K. Beale. It's a great book on idolatry throughout the Bible and what happens to people who are entrapped in idolatry. In his book, We Become What We Worship, G.K. Beale says this: God has made humans to reflect him, but if they do not commit themselves to him, they will not reflect him, but something else in creation. It is not possible to be neutral on this issue. We either reflect the Creator or something in creation. He goes on to say that what people reveal, they resemble either for their ruin or for their restoration. And that is exactly what is happening here. Jabin trusts in man. He turns to man. All his hope is in his armies. Numbers, horses, and chariots. Those are his idols. Those are his gods. And he trusts in them to fight against the only true God there is, the only king. Man stands up and rebels. Why? Because he's hardened his heart against his creator. It is interesting to notice the two difference between the two leaders. Joshua repeatedly turns to God. Man turns to man. He turns to his armies. He turns to his power. He turns to his might. He gathers other kings. He places his trust in the newest technology. And I think there's a connection here between their confidence and the technology that they have. So to have horses and chariots and to have all of these armies was the top of the line. You were the best of the best. You were the superpower of the world. So he turns and he's like, oh, this is, he heard about the southern campaign. He knows what God has done through Joshua and Israel, but he thinks he's going to actually win. That's what happens. That's the delusion of idolatry. Makes people crazy. He says, this is going to be different. Why? We got top of the line equipment. We have the best there is. We do this all the time as humans. I do it when I fish. I feel like if I buy like $300 fishing gear, I have all the waders, I have the best rod, I'm like, yeah, these trout are in big trouble. I got the best, right? We do it all the time. Look at what we have. Look at our capabilities. We trust in ourselves. Jabin's no different here. Man is fooled by technology, and here it's horses and chariots. That's why he thinks this outcome is going to be different. Numbers, horses, and chariots. That's what he's trusting in. That's why God later on warns Israel. What does he say to Israel? What does he warn about future kings? He says, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses. Why? Because man tends to trust in what he can see. He trusts in his creation, not the creator. But later on, Solomon did just that. God wants them to rely on him, but man wants to rely on man. He wants him to rely on what he can see. The author is doing something very intentional here. He's building this battle up, right? If you're watching a movie, it's like kind of like the Lord of the Rings at the Battle of Plenor, right? And there they are, and you see that. I don't know if that's a good picture. It's just tiny little people, but there's thousands of them. But that's the idea here. Here it is, this massive army. It says as numerous as the sands of the sea. And they have armies, plural, and they have horses and chariots, and you can see the imagery. The horses are breathing that smoke from their nose, and they're ready to go, and you see all the guys, and they're lining up, and they have all this armor and all this equipment, and they have all ready to just stand against a significantly undermanned, under-equipped Israel. The world trusts in what it sees. The power of kings stands up against the power of the only true king. The next stage, what happens when man does that? What happens when the kings stand up? They are crippled. Verses 6 through 9. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid." How many times have we heard that in our text? If we get anything from Joshua, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid of them. For tomorrow at this time, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. The Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, so they defeated them and pursued them as far as the great Sidon and Misrath-Maim in the valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck them until there was no survivor left. Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. There's a question that has gone to a certain individual who worked at a museum. Why do so many Egyptian statues have broken noses? It's a common question from visitors to the Brooklyn Museum's Egyptian art galleries. Edward Bleiberg, who oversees the museum's Egyptian art, was surprised the first few times that he heard this question. He had taken it for granted that the sculptures were damaged. Certainly, after thousands of years, ancient artifacts should show some wear and tear. But, he noted, the broken noses led him to uncover a widespread pattern of deliberate destruction. He says this, "The consistency of the patterns of damage found in the sculptures suggests that it's actually purposeful. A protruding nose on a three-dimensional statue is easily broken, yes. But the plot thickens when flat reliefs of the same images also have smashed noses. The ancient Egyptians believed that the essence of a deity could inhabit the image of that deity. These campaigns of vandalism were therefore intended to deactivate an image's strength." The damaged, I know, I said the same thing. I was like, I never realized that. He says, "The damaged part of the body is no longer able to do its job. Without the nose, the statue's spirit ceases to breathe, so that the vandal is effectively killing it. To hammer off the ear of a statue of a god would make it unable to hear prayer. Pharaohs regularly issued decrees with terrible punishments for anyone who would dare threaten their likeness." God is targeting their strength. Notice what God says to Joshua. He is going after their strength. Targeting, intentionally so. He begins this interaction with Joshua again with what? Do not fear. Do not worry about what they have. Yes, they are bigger. Yes, they have a lot of numbers. Yes, they have horses. Yes, they have chariots. But guess what? You got me. Do not fear. When we look out on the horizon and we see all the world's forces amassing against us, it might be scary. But God gives us the command to continually trust in Him. Do not fear. And then He deals with each fear individually, doesn't He? The three things that the author mentions in the beginning of the passage: numbers, horses, and chariots. And God doesn't just generalize it with Joshua. Joshua, don't worry, we got this. I'm going to take care of everything. Oh, Joshua, don't worry. You saw me do it before. I've done it again. I'm going to do it again. Don't worry about it. No. He specifically deals with each three. He says, the people, slain. The horses, hamstrung. The chariots, burned. Sending a message to this king, but also sending a message to his people. And this principle, I think, applies throughout all aspects of our life. God cares about our individual fears, and He can address each one of them. Whatever it is you're afraid of, He doesn't just say, do not fear. He says, I'm going to take care of whatever that problem is you're facing. I'm going to take care of that boss that you're dealing with at work. I'm going to take care of if you're having relationship struggles. I'm going to take care of, fill it in. He cares about that stuff. And He can deal with each fear individually. But overall, He's sending a message. Those things that this world possesses, the might and the power they have, we need not fear. Doesn't matter. It does not matter how strong they are. It doesn't matter if they have the best technology. It doesn't matter if they have all the armies in the world. Do not fear. I love the contrast between the two scenes here. First, you have this king. You know, when you picture him, he's in his robes, he has servants all around him, and he goes and he gets all his commanders together, and they get all their commanders and generals together, and they're giving orders to their armies, and the armies are massing up, and they have horses and chariots, and everyone's talking, and they're all making all these special plans. And then all of a sudden you have God and Joshua. That's it. That's intentional. God, yes, Joshua has an army, but in this scene right here, God is just talking to Joshua. That's it. Just the two of them. God doesn't give a plan. He doesn't say, Joshua, get all the swords you can. Joshua, you better go over back to Egypt and buy the latest technology, because you're going to need it for this one, brother. He doesn't say any of that. Hey, Joshua, here's what you got to do. This is the exact plan to follow. No, he doesn't say anything. It's just a man who trusts in his God. That's it. A man who is submissive to the only true king. A man who doesn't turn to his army, he doesn't turn to his weaponry, but he turns to God. Sometimes in our life, the odds are going to look just like that. That's how they're going to look. Matter of fact, for the church, it always looks like that. The odds stacked against us. But that is exactly where God wants us to be. That is what is going to draw our eyes to Him. Don't focus on those armies. Don't trust in your own armies. Look to me for your strength. He chooses the weak. He chooses the foolish. How many times has He cut down Israel's armies? Why? So that He gets the glory. And Israel doesn't learn to trust in what they have. It's a message to the world, and it's a message to us. There's no amassing of forces in this passage. There's no going out and getting the latest technology. Man who comes against God is surprised when what they trust in just doesn't work. God cripples their forces, cripples everything that they trust in. He allowed them, see what happens, he's allowed them to amass such a force and to be victorious in using those forces over time in battle. The more victorious people become, the more arrogant they become, the more faith that they will have in these powers and in these weapons. And just like Nebuchadnezzar, they look over all that God has given them and they said, "Have I not? Is this not because of me?" But for all of them, there is a tomorrow. And God sets a specific time. Tomorrow, I'm going to give them to you. Tomorrow, their judgment will come. Tomorrow, all that you see before you, all their army, all their chariots, all of their horses will be given into your hands. As I said before, he's targeting what they trust in. To have the chariots during this time was like, as I said, this was it. This was the top of the line military force to have. I used this image of this is a model. I don't know if people collect these things, a little miniature model. And I use this intentionally because I think this is exactly what it looks like to God. Hey, a little model. Oh, look, no horses and chariots coming out. It reminds me of that time in Avengers when they're all excited. I don't know if you've seen Avengers Age of Ultron, but Thor and Cap, and you can call him Cap if you know him well. So Thor and Cap are fighting these guys, and these guys have the newest technology and all these forces, and they're putting up a fight, and they think they're really, really strong. And this tank comes up, and all these forces line up, and Thor turns to Cap, and he goes, "Oh, look, they're lining up." Cap goes, "Well, they're excited." And then he smashes the hammer against the shield, and that was it. It's done. This battle is so anticlimactic, it's pathetic. It's not pathetic, but for a movie, for some sort of, it's anticlimactic. What happens? It doesn't say anything. You think they're going to line up, and they're all going to clash, and like, man, this is going to be a great battle. God's like, "No, I'm just going to hand them to you slain." All we know is that Joshua went after them, and then they turn tail and they run. That's it. All their horses, their chariots, their armies absolutely amounted to nothing. God doesn't even give them a battle to talk about. That's what he does. And I think what is funny, so this again and again and again, we see that trusting in God doesn't negate human action. Joshua turns and surprises them. And I think this was a surprise, because I actually believe that they never even got to use their horses and chariots. I think that this attack happened on a tell. It was an elevated area where their horses and chariots were absolutely useless. I think they thought this is a sneak attack by Joshua. Comes when they're not expecting it. They were going to meet them on a plain where they can use all these things. They never got to use them to begin with. That's how God operates. Gives our enemies, no matter how strong they are, into our hands. Again and again and again. Divine assurance does not negate human action. Man is okay as long as they have these things. What happens when those things are taken away and they realize they are not as safe as they think? They turn and they either blame God or they seek him in desperation. But as long as they trust in these things, they're going to fight. They're going to take their stand, and when they do, God will cripple them. The third and final, and when they do, God will cripple them. They have placed their trust in these areas. The point, the main thrust of this passage is if we trust in the Lord of the kings, we need not fear the power of men. This is what happens when man places their trust in man, when man places their trust in technology, when man places their faith in another king. They're crippled.
for us, we trust in him. And as the psalm says, some trust in horses and chariots. Some are right here before us. What happens to those who trust in horses and chariots? They're done. But we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. We need not fear when man amasses an army against us. But also, we need to remember not to trust in those things that man trusts in. Not to trust in how great our worship music is, right? Not to trust in all of our degrees. Not to trust in how good we are at answering the world's arguments. And I say this, all of those things are good. We need to reach our culture. We need to use what God has given us. But they are not an ends to themselves. That is not where our trust is to lie. That is not how we are to fight our battles. We fight our battles placing our trust in him. Him alone. He is going to do the work. He has done it before. He is doing it now, and he will do it again in the future. That is where our trust is, and it never, ever, ever, ever should change. The third and final stage that happens to these kings who rise up against the king is they fall, verses 10 through 15. Then Joshua turned back at that time, captured Hazor and struck it with its sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. All the spoil of these cities and the cattle and the sons of Israel they took as plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. There was no one left to breathe, just as the Lord commanded Moses, his servant. So Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. The author makes it a point here to let us know that Hazor was the head of all of these kingdoms. God is making a statement. What happens to those who follow men? What happens to those who follow the kings of the earth? They fall. Now the head is cut off, literally. The king who thought he could stand against the one and only true king has now met his creator. And he who was refused on earth can be refused no more. The king of Hazor is bowing before the one and only true king. And take note of the two actors, Jabin, the king of Hazor, and Joshua. Joshua's an old man, well into his 80s, leader of a nation that at this time really has no earthly kingdom fully realized. He's leader of an army that is not technologically advanced, and it is he who kills this king. It's Joshua, because he followed the one and only true king. He kills the king who sat on a throne, lived in luxury, had every resource at his disposal, ruled over a vast army, had the latest technology, but he falls to the sword of a Jewish nobody. A nobody in the eyes of this world, but a somebody in the eyes of his God. A nobody who trusted in the one and only true king. A nobody who understood the proper chain of command. I love that end part there. Kings give commands, right? King Hazor, Jabin gave commands. He gave commands to his generals. His generals gave commands to the captains. The captains gave commands to the leaders. That was the chain of command for there. Look at the chain of command for Joshua. God commands Moses. Moses commands Joshua, and Joshua follows it out. The world can give all the commands in the world. They can give commands to militaries. They can give commands to fight. They can give commands to battle. But the only commands that matter are the ones that come from that king. That was the command. And we see the result of those that follow such a command. It does not matter how big our armies are. It matters how big our king is. He doesn't need an army. He's his own army. Kings and kingdoms may rise up. They may seem so glorious. They may have all the might that the world has to offer, and they may take their stand against God and his people, but their fate is all the same when that command is given. They stand, they're crippled, and they fall. This is the story. This is how all of these battles are going to play out. It doesn't matter what they have. It's all the same when they stand against the one and true king. All that they have is destroyed, and it will burn. All their glory, their wealth, all their security, burned down to nothing, shown for what it truly is. And that is going to happen again. And it's not going to be limited to just one city, is it? It's going to cover the entire earth. Fire has a finality to it. And fire was always used of God's judgment. Things are changed when fire touches it. It's changed physically, chemically, intrinsically. That which is consumed ceases to exist. It's a message. This is a picture of the Chicago Fire 1871, the Sherman Building, completely destroyed. Gentleman, an author, says this: in the Bible, God has always used fire as a symbol of judgment, and for a very good reason, because the ancient world understood fire as a very terrible, destructive force. One of the greatest fires in the ancient world occurred in Rome in AD 64. Tacitus writes, amid the shops containing inflammable wares, the conflagration broke out instantaneously, became so fierce and so rapid from the wind that it seized in its grasp the entire length of the Circus Maximus. Soon the whole broad valley between the Palatine and the Venetine hills was a sea of fire, checked only by the Tiber River. Then the flames licked up the hillsides, climbing the buildings and temples that crowned them, far outstripping the efforts of fire brigades. That fire continued, it stopped, and then it started again and burnt more. He ends with this: old men will remember many things which cannot be replaced. Everything that the king of Hazor trusted in is demolished. It's destroyed. And we know that another fire is coming for those who turn against the one and only true king. This is Hazor now. These ruins were discovered in 1928 by a British archaeologist. Hazor was a large and important Canaanite city built near Lake Merom, which was strategically located on ancient trading routes. It was a city that was even more important than Jericho at that time. The city was first investigated in 1928 by a British archaeologist, and excavations continued at intervals for many decades after that, up to 2012. Hazor's great Acropolis was found, fortifications, the citadel, storage facilities, houses, water systems, artifacts, and jewelry. The archaeological evidence has shown that a violent fire destroyed the palace in about 13th century BC. I don't know how they know this, but they said the fire was so intense, with temperatures going up 2 times more than temperatures of a normal fire to a stunning 1,300 degrees Celsius. I can't do the math either, so I had to look it up. That's 2,372 degrees Fahrenheit. Completely melted clay vessels and the mud bricks that the walls were made of. The combination of large quantities of wood used for building and olive oil stored in rooms, as well as strong winds, were responsible for such a destruction. We know the how, but we also know the why. The why was because that's what the king trusted in. His power, his might, his armies, his forces. And because he did, he stood up, he was crippled, and he fell. And that's what happens to those who do not trust in the Lord of the Kings. And because we trust in him, we need not fear them. Father, thank you for this truth that we sometimes can forget when we look at this world. We look at what we see. Sometimes we trust in what we see, Lord. Help us to carry out your purposes no matter who stands against us, no matter how great they are, no matter how wonderful their technology is. Help us to keep our eyes focused on the one and only true King, and to do it for your glory and your glory alone. In Jesus' name, amen.